From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republican Congressman and House Majority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana is out of surgery and in stable condition after he was shot in the hip this morning during a GOP congressional baseball practice at a park in Alexandria, Virginia. President Trump addressed Scalise earlier today during his first public statement since the shooting.
And Steve, I want you to know that you have the prayers not only of the entire city behind you, but of an entire nation and, frankly, the entire world. America is praying for you, and America is praying for all of the victims of this terrible shooting.
At least four other people were wounded, including two Capitol Police officers and two congressional staff members. The gunman has been identified as 66-year-old James Hodkinson of Belleville, Illinois, who was, according to his Facebook page, a Bernie Sanders supporter. Today, Sanders, speaking from the floor of the Senate, said he apparently was a volunteer, and that thought sickened him. Bracton Booker is with Here and Now contributor WAMU in Washington. Bracton, the shooting took place around 7 o'clock this morning. Surreal, you know, a baseball practice in the park. What do we know about what happened?
Well, yeah, a baseball practice very early in the morning. The practice was for Republican congressmen who were preparing for the charity baseball game where Republicans and Democrats play each other. That game is set for tomorrow at Nationals Park where the Nationals play. But the practice started at 6:30 in the morning. So, I mean, you can imagine people are walking their dogs, getting ready to work. So it's pretty quiet. And apparently the alleged gunman came up and began opening fire just after 7 o'clock. Apparently, there was quite a bit of confusion, although I will say that because Steve Scalise, who is the number three Republican in the House of Representatives, because he is in leadership, he had a security detail. So there were armed officers on scene when the shooting began, but reinforcements from the Alexandria police got on the scene within a couple of minutes, and that's when an exchange of gunfire took place in the early morning in this really, really pristine suburb in Alexandria, Virginia.
Well, Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona was one of those who was there. He spoke earlier with CNN.
Steve Scalise was on second base, playing second base, fielding balls, and all of a sudden we heard a very loud shot. Everybody thought, that sounds like a gun. And the gunman was over by the third base dugout with a clear view of the field and everybody on it. And then all of a sudden, a couple more shots, and we knew what it was.
And Senator Rand Paul was also there. He said that, you know, without that security detail, he thinks it would have had a much worse outcome. He jumped a fence when the shooter began firing and said a car stopped, and he jumped in with an aide and they drove away. I mean, really quite a scene. What's the mood there now?
Well, Robert, I'm not on scene. I'm at WAMU.
Oh, but I mean in Washington,
In Washington. Oh, yeah, in Washington, of course. But, yeah, the mood is really shock. I mean, the news of the day coming in today was, what is Janet Yellen going to do? Is she going to raise interest rates? So that was kind of the story that was on people's minds, right? So there's increased security at the Capitol. There are swarms of reporters at local hospitals trying to get word on, you know, updates on victims. But everyone is kind of on edge right now, just because they're not sure where this came from.
Well, we mentioned that the alleged shooter seemed to have been a supporter of Bernie Sanders, who says he is sick about that. But there seems to be unity. Let's just listen to House Speaker Paul Ryan speaking and receiving an ovation when he said this.
We are united in our shock. We are united in our anguish. An attack on one of us is an attack on all of us.
Paul Ryan speaking in the House. And Bracton, we have a couple seconds here, but we understand the House has shut down all legislative activity for the day.
That is correct. The baseball game that I mentioned, as of now, it is still on for tomorrow. A couple of quick things on the investigation. The FBI has taken over because Scalise was a federal official. So the feds are now going to take over the lead.
Bracton Booker of WAMU, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, we continue to follow developments in London, where a huge fire at a high-rise residential apartment building has left at least 12 people dead and more than 70 injured. The cause of the fire is being investigated. Meanwhile, as British Prime Minister Theresa May scrambles to hold on to power after losing her majority in the recent elections, a former prime minister is warning her about forming a coalition with the Democratic Unionist Party, or DUP, of Northern Ireland. Former British Prime Minister John Major says Theresa May runs the risk of harming the fragile peace plan in Northern Ireland, a plan that effectively ended the troubles between Protestants and Catholics. Joining us now is BBC News Ireland correspondent Chris Page. He's in Belfast, Northern Ireland. Chris, welcome.
Good to be on your show.
Well, and first of all, what is the status of Theresa May's efforts to form a new government in Britain?
Well, she is going to have to rely on the support of the Democratic Unionist Party, and it's very rare that a party from Northern Ireland finds itself in this sort of position. Usually politics in Northern Ireland, which is very different to the rest of the UK, goes on, and people in England, Scotland and Wales don't really take a huge amount of notice. But after the general election last week, it's all very different. The arithmetic in the Parliament in London means that Theresa May needs the support of 10 MPs belonging to the DUP in order for her to command a majority by which she is able to pass legislation. So she has gone to the DUP and they're currently trying to hammer out a deal. In terms of the party's ideology, the DUP have quite often in the past lined up with Theresa May's Conservative Party anyway, so there's already quite a lot of common ground. To some extent, they're natural political bedfellows, but the DUP are asking for some things from Theresa May's government as the price of their support. In particular, they may want more economic investment in Northern Ireland. They might want new counter-terrorism measures, and also they'll be wanting to talk about the issue of the UK's departure from the European Union, which will affect Northern Ireland particularly profoundly, given that Northern Ireland's the only part of the UK that has a land border with another European Union state, namely the Republic of Ireland.
And the DUP is also very conservative on some social issues, right, like same-sex marriage and abortion?
Well, that's correct. Northern Ireland is currently the only part of the UK where same-sex couples can't get married. And the reason for that is basically that the DUP here, the largest party in Northern Ireland, are opposed to same-sex marriage. They also are opposed to any change in the abortion laws in Northern Ireland, which are much more restrictive than in the rest of the UK. Abortion is legal, but only in circumstances where the woman's life is at risk. Terminations are more freely available in England, Scotland and Wales. The reason why the DUP has a conservative stance on social issues is that really a lot of their members will have a strong personal Christian faith. The party was founded by a preacher, a churchman, the Reverend Ian Paisley. He always would have said he was a churchman first and a politician second. So that religious influence, although Mr. Paisley died several years ago, still very much is present in the ethos of the party today. And their social stance, their stance on those social issues would be at odds with the Conservative parties. However, the DUP have been at pains to stress that actually those social issues and the fact that there is a difference between the two parties isn't going to make any difference to these negotiations. They're not going to be asking the Conservative Party for any change to their position on abortion and same-sex marriage.
So what about this warning from the former Conservative Prime Minister John Major that if Theresa May links up with the DUP, the peace process in Northern Ireland could be at risk?
Well, I think Sir John Major's comments are significant. Sir John Major was the Prime Minister of the UK in the 1990s during the early part of the Northern Ireland peace process. He was Prime Minister whenever the main paramilitary groups here declared ceasefires in 1994. And when he left office in 1997, his government had already done a lot of the groundwork for the Good Friday Agreement, the peace accord, which effectively brought an end to the conflict in Northern Ireland. That was signed in 1998 under the UK premiership of Tony Blair. Now, the fact that John Major has come out and made these comments is significant because it echoes what senior figures in Tony Blair's administration have also been saying. The concern is that under the terms of the peace accord, the British and Irish governments have to be seen as rigorously impartial in their dealing with the two sides in Northern Ireland. And at the moment, there are sensitive political negotiations going on because the power-sharing regional government in Northern Ireland collapsed about 6 months ago. So the Warrior officer John Major and several figures who were closely involved with Tony Blair during the years of the Northern Ireland peace process is that the British government can't now be seen to be neutral in the process if they are linked up with the Democratic Unionist Party in London. Now, as regards the threat to the peace process, well, really very few, actually, I would say hardly anybody at all in Northern Ireland thinks that Northern Ireland's going to return to large-scale violence such as that we saw between the late 1960s and the late 1990s. But political relationships are still delicate. There is still tension between the communities, and the worry of the likes of Sir John Major is that the political relations could be upset further, and that wouldn't be good for Northern Ireland.
That's the BBC's Chris Page joining us from Belfast in Northern Ireland. Chris, thank you.
Thank you. Good to be on your program.
We had planned a Washington roundup today, and there is lots going on, although this morning's shooting at a GOP baseball practice that wounded House Majority Whip Steve Scalise and four others has stunned D.C., the House shutting down all legislative activity for the day.
And shutting down some parts of D.C. in a way, and our Angela Rye, Democratic strategist, is unable at this moment to get to our studio because of it, but Angela joins us by phone. Hi, Angela.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And Paris Denard, Republican strategist, is with us as well. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello.
And Paris, let me just start with you, your reaction to this shooting today, which it appears was carried out by somebody who had volunteered on Bernie Sanders' campaign.
Yes. You know, first of all, my condolences go out to Congressman Scalise and the families of Zach, Matt, David and Crystal, who are all affected by this tragedy, were shot.
Actually, you know what, Paris? You remind me. Let's get those names out there. Zachary Barth, right?
Right.
Staffer for Representative Roger Williams from Texas. Matt
right.
Mika, government relations director at Tyson Foods, and
right.
Special Agent David Bailey of the U.S. Capitol Police. There's also another special agent, Crystal Greiner. So we wanted to make sure we got those names out there. And you knew one of the organizers of this event.
Yes, Ryan Thompson is a very good friend of mine, a longtime organizer for it. He put on his Facebook that he's okay. Congressman Roger Williams is a longtime personal friend of mine, and I spoke to his daughter this morning, and she said that he was in good spirits. He was mostly concerned about Zach, his staffer. The congressman ran to flee gunshots, went to the dugout and injured his ankle. So he was not shot, as reports had indicated, but he injured himself. But I think it just drives home this point. Democrat or Republican, every person who goes to Capitol Hill, who goes to Congress, whether they're a staffer, an agent, or a congressman, are public servants who put their lives on the line every single day to advance the cause of making this country better. Now, they may do it from a Democrat perspective or a Republican perspective, but we should all remember and respect the sacrifice that they make for our benefit every single day. And so it's a time for us to put partisanship aside, and I am glad that the baseball game will continue. I've gone multiple years. I had already purchased my tickets, and a group of us are still going tomorrow.
Angela, what about you? What are you thinking about today after this shooting?
You know, the first thing I thought about was the fact that so often Capitol Hill police are some of our greatest heroes. They are close friends to this day. When I go to Capitol Hill, they're asking about how things are going, or they're telling me how proud they are when they hear me on NPR or see me on CNN. And so often they're really truly our unspoken heroes. So I'm grateful for their service. They are truly model examples, a gold star standard for law enforcement. And you saw that once again today. Security details are so often, you know, as they should be, in obscurity. They're there to protect House and Senate leadership. And I'm glad that they were there today, because if they hadn't been there, God only knows what would have happened. I couldn't agree with Paris more about the importance of bipartisanship. It was a beautiful moment on the House floor to see Nancy Pelosi and Paul Ryan talk about the importance of coming together, and how at the end of the day, an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. So I thought it was a great moment, and I can only hope that the spirit of bipartisanship continues and it doesn't take another tragedy to bring everyone together.
Look, we want to move on to, you know, so much else happening, but I just want to ask you, Paris, do you think that will hold? I mean, now that people know that this was allegedly a supporter, or the alleged shooter was a supporter of Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders has acknowledged that and said it disgusts him. But is this going to be fodder? I mean, also, you know, some are calling for a closer look at gun control, you know, a conversation that follows shootings. But do you think it will become partisan?
You know, this is D.C. So soon, I mean, I already saw tweets from the left, from people making it a partisan issue, and that's unfortunate.
Well, we should say there's some from the right as well.
Right. I'm just talking about the ones that I saw, and I think that that's unfortunate. I believe that what we have to remember is that, look, in 1998, when Detectives Gibson and Chestnut were gunned down in the Capitol, we had to stop and say, what are we doing? So many years later, we're still dealing with the effects of people who are deranged. I don't care that the man was a Bernie Sanders supporter. What I'm most concerned about is his disdain for this president and the Republicans were so great that he would take a gun and mow them down. That's the problem. Not that he's a Bernie Sanders supporter, but his hatred was so great that he would take these efforts.
All right, and we'll continue to follow this. And I want to get on to some of the other things that are happening in Washington that we wanted to hear from you about, starting with Attorney General Jeff Sessions' testimony yesterday before the Senate Intelligence Committee regarding Russian interference in the 2016 election. Let's listen here to a clip of Sessions.
Let me state this clearly, colleagues. I have never met with or had any conversation with any Russians or any foreign officials concerning any type of interference with any campaign or election in the United States. Further, I have no knowledge of any such conversations by anyone connected to the Trump campaign. I was your colleague in this body for 20 years, at least some of you, and the suggestion that I participated in any collusion, that I was aware of any collusion with the Russian government to hurt this country, which I have served with honor for 35 years, or to undermine the integrity of our democratic process, is an appalling and detestable lie.
Angela, what stood out to you in Sessions' testimony yesterday?
Well, the primary thing that stood out to me is the fact that he continued to say he did not recall. And these events that were being spoken of were not that long ago for him to not recall. So to me, it demonstrated a willingness to not want to perjure himself. I thought one other thing that was profound was Senator King's questioning of him, asking him if he was invoking executive privilege. And you saw Jeff Sessions kind of stumble into this. It wasn't his right to claim executive privilege. And there were a number of people, I think not just lay people, but also senators, who did not realize that he could not invoke executive privilege of himself. He had to rely on the president to do it. And then he tried to preserve the right for the president to do it at a later date, which he also is not needed to do. Donald Trump can do that on his own. So I think one of the things that really stood out to me is the lengths that he would go to not disclose what actually happened. And I think Senator Kamala Harris did a great job of really drilling that home. Why didn't he study the policy that he was relying upon so heavily?
Well, in fact, we have a clip of Kamala Harris, a rising star in the Democratic Party, questioning Sessions about the Department of Justice policy he cited as the reason he couldn't discuss private conversations he had with the president.
Is that policy in writing somewhere?
I think so.
So did you not consult it before you came before this committee, knowing we would ask you questions about
that? Well, we talked about it. The policy is
based... Did you ask that it would be shown to you?
The policy is based on the principle that the president...
Sir, I'm not asking about the principle. I'm asking when
you
would be asked these questions and you would rely on that policy.
Chairman,
did you not ask your staff to show you the policy that would be the basis for you refusing to answer the majority of questions that have been asked of you?
Should be allowed to answer the question.
Senators will allow the chair to control the hearing. Senator Harris, let him answer.
Please do. Thank you.
We talked about it.
So this was the second time in a week, by the way, that Republican senators cut Harris off in a Senate Intelligence Committee meeting. But, Paris, I want to go to you for a second. Some have pointed to that as a moment where Sessions didn't hold up very well. Your thoughts?
I disagree. I thought the attorney general what I appreciated the most, Robin, was the fact that this attorney general was so steadfast and so strong and so declarative in his statements and in his responses that he was their colleague. They know him, and the fact he was so offended that they would attempt to impugn his reputation and besmirch his character through the politics of personal destruction, to imply that he somehow was involved in collusion. And he raised a very good question. He answered in saying, "This investigation is about whether or not the Russians colluded with this campaign. But more importantly, if there was proof that the Russians did something with this election, that's what we need to be focused on, not whether or not the attorney general was in a room or not with the Russian ambassador, who, might I add, met with many people on the left, Democrat senators between 2009 and 2016. So it wasn't like this was uncommon. So if it was good for the goose, it's good for the gander. But at the end of the day, remember, the attorney general asked for the hearing to be made open and to be public because he had nothing to hide. And that was an important fact. He could have done this behind closed doors. They could have exercised executive privilege, but he did none of that. He's answered the questions to the best of his knowledge, and he did a good job.
You know, this, I think, is so representative. Just a second, Angela. This is just so representative of what's happening in this country right now, which is two people are watching this hearing and seeing two completely different things.
Very. Yeah. You know, I think I just have to point out, I would be interested to know what questions Paris heard him answer, because I think it was very clear to most of the senators on both sides of the aisle that he was relying on a policy that sounded very similar to executive privilege. I think the other thing that I really wished that at least some of the Democratic senators would have drilled home was the fact that it wasn't just that he misspoke during his testimony when Senator Franken questioned him on his contact with Russian officials. He also misspoke or miswrote, right? In his responses to Senator Leahy, he relied on that same foul intelligence. It was not right. It was inaccurate. And he cleared it up later in a newspaper article. The reason why Attorney General Jeff Sessions was before that committee yesterday is because he misrepresented the truth during his nomination hearing. That is a major flag.
That's Angela Rye, a Democratic strategist. Paris Denard, we gave you each equal time. I know you probably want to respond, but with the time we have, not now. Paris Denard, a Republican strategist. Angela stuck in traffic because of all the goings on in Washington. We thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions, and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle, and it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
Police in San Francisco are responding to a workplace shooting at a UPS facility near the Mission District neighborhood. UPS says the shooter was an employee. Meanwhile, in Washington, FBI Special Agent Tim Slater says he's not aware of any political motivations, but the FBI is looking into all angles after the shooting early this morning at a GOP congressional baseball practice in Alexandria, Virginia. The gunman has now died from wounds from return fire. Senator Bernie Sanders says he's learned the man was a volunteer in his campaign and that sickens him. Majority Whip Steve Scalise, one of the five people shot, is in stable condition. NPR's Greg Myrie has been following all of this. What a day, Greg. First of all, what more do we know about the shooter?
Wow. Well, his name is James Hodgkinson. He's 66. He's from Belleville, Illinois, which is a small sort of working class, middle class town just across the Mississippi River from St. Louis. He worked there as a home inspector, had some minor brushes with the law, according to the local paper, the Bellevue News Democrat. There was DUI, some traffic offenses, failure to get some permits, but nothing that would have pointed to a violent act like this.
Yeah. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders today on the floor of the Senate.
I have just been informed that the alleged shooter at the Republican baseball practice this morning is someone who apparently volunteered on my presidential campaign. I am sickened by this despicable act.
So many reverberations there. But, Greg, you know, what more do we know? You know, the FBI spokesperson says they have no idea about motivation. But what more do we know about what happened? I mean, we're hearing about congressmen and senators and congressional aides scattering when this gun was revealed.
Right. So there's this early morning practice, and they go out there three times a week. And one of the congressmen said he was leaving early and was asked by a bystander, are these Democrats or Republican? And he told them they were Republicans. And the guy didn't have a weapon, did nothing, looked out of the ordinary. But it turns out, according to the congressman, that this is the guy that started shooting from behind a gate or through a chain link fence at the Republicans who were out there at 7 in the morning practicing baseball. Sort of from behind the third base side on the chain link fence. And then a couple Capitol Police officers came to the rescue.
Yeah, and by the way, they, two security people were shot, but we understand everybody is in, okay condition. And Steve Scalise had that security detail, again, because he's the majority whip. And people like Rand Paul are saying, thank goodness, because they fear it would have been much worse. Here's Chief of the Capitol Police, Matthew Verderosa.
Suffice it to say that our officers acted, I believe, heroically today, and they're in good condition, and we look for a rapid recovery.
Greg, I'm imagining that people in the city today are talking about security. I mean, how do you protect people at baseball games?
Oh, yeah. Again, this is something that they wouldn't have normally had protection at, only because Steve Scalise was there. Did you have these two officers? Otherwise, they would have just been sitting ducks out there. So it could have been much, much worse. Many more people injured or killed. These two Capitol Police officers really came to the rescue.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie in Washington after today's shooting in Alexandria, Virginia, at a GOP baseball practice for a charity game that, Greg, we understand is still going to go on.
Tomorrow night, still going on as planned.
Greg, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
It's time once again for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Eric J. Lawrence is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He is with us. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's get to the music that you brought us. This is the English musician Christian Fitness with Bees Mode.
Let's talk about bees. Yes, the things you see sometimes in the trees. Chasing sweet food in yellow flirtinis. Had a hit single sometime in the 90s. And the foresight to wear 50-50 in the series. Foreign agents hiding in their fairy teepees. Madness, madness. That's so eerie. The more you lean on it, the less it needs supporting. The more you lean on it, the less it needs supporting. The more you lean on it, the less it needs supporting.
Tell us about this one.
So Christian Fitness is sort of the pseudonym for his solo project. Andy Falkus is the guy's name. He is the leader of the band Future of the Left, and really is the modern master of this kind of angular rhythmic punk music. And, you know, so much in the indie world these days is a little more softer and contemplative, and I just am really embracing his anger as an energy sort of modus operandi.
What is it that you like about it?
It's just the production of it is very tight, and so it's sort of wound up, but it just really gets to a point, and with his very British sensibilities with the lyrics. I mean, a lot of the song titles are quite cheeky. Things like "Footballers Have Feelings Too," "Hallowed Be Thy Naming Rights." There's an attitude that's there, and combined with this just really sort of driving music is something that I've been missing recently.
All right. Well, this is the American indie folk band The Mountain Goats. They're based in Durham, North Carolina. This is called "Stench of the Unburied."
I know we're going to crash, and outside it's 92 degrees, and KROQ is playing Susie and the Banshees.
Well, when he says it's 92 degrees outside, he must be talking about where I am, because it has been very hot in recent days. But tell us more about this one.
So the Mountain Goats, longstanding indie favorites. John Darnielle is the leader of the band and has been making music for 20 years or so. This latest record, the album's called Goths, is sort of a concept album around goth music. And so he makes frequent references throughout the songs to very specific things. In that particular clip, we heard him referencing the radio station KROQ here in Los Angeles playing Susie and the Banshees. And I play that sort of as a nod to the legendary DJ Rodney Bingenheimer, who was one of the mainstays of that radio station, who just this past month, his longstanding show at the station has ended. And he's just a legendary figure in music radio. He has a star in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He gets shouted out by a lot of bands like Blondie when they're inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And is just one of those sort of very curious peripheral figures that I think needs to be remembered.
And in terms of the Mountain Goats, we read on their Facebook page that they say the group began when one of the members, quote, started setting some of his poetry to music using a guitar he'd gotten for a few bucks at a nearby strip mall music store.
Yes. Very lo-fi. The initial releases from the Mountain Goats were all on cassette tape. That's now kind of come back around to be the hipster thing to do. And it's also a very curious, I don't know how it goes with the theme necessarily, but this is also an unusual record where there's no guitar on the album. It's all he plays keyboards throughout the record.
All right, well, next we go to a place where it is definitely not 92 degrees, and that would be Canada, and the singer-songwriter Daniel Romano. This is Modern Pressure.
Sounds that mother.
Now, this is off his seventh album, which he describes as the sound of the moment reverberating into the future.
Okay. I'll take him at his word of that. I have to admit, this is sort of the first album of his that I've really fully delved into. But, you know, it's sort of easy to claim him as Dylan-esque. But there is something about his delivery, the metaphor-heavy lyrics, the cadence, and that kind of upper North American drawl that he's got.
I've also heard him compared to the Ramones.
Well, he makes a specific Ramones reference on this record as well. There's another track called The Pride of Queens, and he gives a little Gabba Gabba Hey shout-out in that song, too. So,
Well, up next, we go back to the past. Your next pick is from the California 80s and 90s group Game Theory. This is Throwing the Election. So this is not an 80s and 90s song that I have heard before. Tell us about it.
Well, that's sort of the thing. Game Theory were one of those bands kind of lost in the shuffle. They were part of what was known as the Paisley Underground, sort of a 60s psychedelic revival. And Scott Miller is the leader of the band and just wrote these very clever, catchy, memorable pop songs. But just never really quite made it. In fact, it comes from their last album from 1988 called Two Steps from the Middle Ages. And the record label Enigma Records went belly up shortly thereafter. And he later formed another band called The Loud Family and then sadly passed away suicide in 2013. And so Omnivore, which is one of the better reissue labels at the moment, have been going through a campaign of reissuing their albums in deluxe editions with all sorts of bonus material, and this is the latest. And it's something worth revisiting, and I'm glad it's sort of being put back in front of people.
Okay, well, you have one more for us. This is by the English actress and songwriter Jane Birkin. It's called Requiem pour un con.
Écoute les angles, elle joue pour toi. Il est terrible, cette terre-là. J'espère que tu aimes. C'est assez bon, non? C'est le requiem pour un con.
Where did you find this one?
So this is a tribute to Serge Gainsbourg, who is the French musician, songwriter, and was Jane Birkin's romantic partner through the late 60s and the 70s. In fact, the parents of Charlotte Gainsbourg. Jane had worked with him as an actress on a couple of films, but also recording some of his music. And most famously, the single Je t'aime, pas non plus, which was this controversial single from 1969 that sort of has these panting noises in it and stuff, and everybody all worked up about that. But when Serge, he died in 1991 at the age of 62, but Jane has always sort of kind of flied the flag of supporting his music. So this was a new record that was put together. It was arranged by a Japanese musician, Nobuyaki Nakajima. And it's orchestral interpretations of Serge Gainsbourg's work that has Jane Birkin singing on it. And it really is just sort of a fun reinterpretation of this sort of classic music, certainly classic from the French standpoint, but has become sort of an international favorite as well.
And worth pointing out this other fact about Jane Birkin. She was the inspiration for the Hermès Birkin bag. Apparently, she was sitting next to the then-CEO Jean-Louis Dumas on a flight in 1984, and when she put her bag in the overhead bin, everything fell out of the bag, and she told him she couldn't find a weekend bag that she liked, so he made her one. And there it is, the Hermès Birkin bag.
An actress, a singer, and a fashion accessory inspiration.
Exactly. Eric J. Lawrence, a DJ at KCRW, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And if you want to hear more, go to our Spotify playlist. Just search for NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at
hereandnow.org.
Hawaii became the first state to pass a law committing to the Paris Climate Accord just after President Trump withdrew the U.S. from that agreement. We have Hawaii Governor David Ige to talk about that. And Governor, it's worth noting, was also a Hawaiian judge who blocked President Trump's travel ban. And that led Attorney General Jeff Sessions to comment that he was amazed that a judge sitting on an island in the Pacific could issue an order that stopped the President of the United States. Your thoughts, an island in the Pacific?
Certainly, the Attorney General and maybe those in the cabinet need to get a geography lesson. As you know, Hawaii became a state more than 50 years ago.
And it's several islands. How do you see the impact of climate change?
I do believe that island communities see it in more extreme ways than others. We've seen sea level changes, king tides, are definitely having an impact.
These are these huge high tides. In fact, we understand you're seeing the highest tides you've seen in 120 years of recording them, these king tides that don't just come up on the shore, they go up under the streets.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of our highways are along the shorelines. And so we've had significant problems with erosion along the highways.
Mm. Well, we understand, coral is being bleached. We know that being killed. And that not only hits at everyone's hearts, but it hits at your tourism, people who come to dive to look at the coral.
But more importantly, it impacts our resident community, you know, many of whom enjoy fresh fish and enjoy just being in the ocean.
So start with trying to cut emissions. How are you going to do that?
Well, we are the only state in the country committed to 100% clean energy for electricity generation, and we are several years into that program. We've had a dramatic increase in production of electricity through solar panels, wind farms. And so for many of us in Hawaii, and clearly there is a large consensus in our community, clean energy matters, and so we have been taking action and reducing greenhouse gases regardless of any Paris Agreement, but we certainly felt compelled to stand up to be counted.
How are you going to try to keep with the Paris Accord without federal dollars to support you? I mean, you'll have the usual federal dollars states have, but
yes,
not the extra that you would have had if the U.S. was in the agreement.
You know, as I had said, you know, we are fortunate in that there is consensus in our community that we have to take aggressive action on reducing greenhouse gases and moving to a clean energy. We went from, I believe, 94% or so dependent on imported fossil fuel to we are at about 74% at the end of last year, on our way to 30% by 2030. You know, and so we feel confident it transforms our economy, and we are committed to do it by ourselves if necessary.
But you're not alone. You've also joined the U.S. Climate Alliance as a collection of 12 states and Puerto Rico, vowing to uphold the Paris Climate Agreement on the state level, again, cutting emissions primarily. Will you help each other?
Certainly. There has been many discussions amongst the governors at the National Governors Association, and clearly I think many other governors and states are committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
But some of the criticism of you as governor, you know, the rising temperatures in Hawaii have meant really hot classrooms for kids. You had a goal of cooling 1,000 classrooms at a cost of $100 million by 2016. Only 200 classrooms have had the air conditioning units installed. But while you try to fulfill this goal of cooling the classrooms, you are adding to the problem of global warming by adding all these air conditioners.
No, we're not.
Okay.
And I just wanted to let you know that over the next 2 months, we will be getting to that 1,000 classrooms. We are also using solar-powered air conditioners. So on the surface, it might seem like they're contradictory. They absolutely are not.
What do you think of the fact that there are people in Washington who don't believe that climate change is real or don't believe that it's man-made or man-influenced?
Certainly, I think we've seen, and I've been telling people, we believe that climate change is real. We have had more severe hurricane seasons in the last 5 years. And so certainly I invite them to come to Hawaii to engage. We definitely can show them the real impacts of climate change to Hawaii. Yeah.
And just one last question, Governor. The Ninth Circuit Court just upheld the Hawaii judge's decision blocking President Trump's travel ban. How'd you view it from the islands?
Certainly. I truly believe that we made the right decision in challenging a travel ban that had little factual basis to justify it, and most importantly, discriminated based strictly on national origin and religion. As you know, Hawaii is a special place. We have no majority. Each and every one of us who live in Hawaii is a minority. And we've learned a long time ago to celebrate the diversity. And I think most importantly, we learned that when we work together, we can do great things. And we've done it in the past, and we are committed to advocating in the future.
That's David Ige, the governor of Hawaii. Governor Ige, thanks for speaking to us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.